be on that side also.
Left top thing up and.
All set.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this House Transportation and Economic Development Committee this wonderful Monday, February 1st, 2016, my husband's birthday. All right. I would like to wish him a happy birthday. Yes. I won't see him today, but I hope he's enjoying himself. Our first order of business today is an organizational meeting to adopt our proposed committee rules. You all have those in front of you, I believe, and I would entertain a motion to adopt.
Wait, for me?
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll edit that out. Right. Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we adopt the Transportation and Economic Development Committee rules.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gorsuch. We'll wait a second for.
Sorry about that. Another committee.
Oh, sure.
How are we doing?
We are all a bit rushed today, so please excuse us as we settle into this very busy session that is starting. We have a motion on the floor to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any objection? Any comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I will just note that as a member of the Rules Committee that helped revise this with the clerk, a word for the wise and the wary, which is while amendments will be on the name,
right.
Our names will be on all amendments now, mm-hmm. There's the option under House rules to have the amendment at the request of a particular organization. But if that is not included with the email or document that requests the amendment, your name will be on it, and it has to be concurrent therewith. So if you remember an hour later, oh, I should have said that amendment was at the request of the Oregon Society for Better Oregon, you may be out of luck, and it's going to have your name on it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Davis, for clarifying that. It's something you all need to be interested in, as well as the work that we do in drafting amendments. So the landscape just changed. But without any other objection, the rules are adopted. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 4020, and I would like to invite Representative Reed up to tee this up, and whoever you'd like to bring with you.
Thank you.
I'm just waiting to see which chair you want to sit in.
Thank you, Representative Reed, for being here today to bring this to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to hear from Patrick with the summary, or should we go ahead? I'm happy to
Patrick,
do whatever is your
go
want.
Ahead and read the summary.
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. House Bill 4020 replaces the requirement that management companies and state agencies under contract with the Oregon Growth Board invest a specified amount in Oregon with rulemaking authority for the board to require the investment in Oregon. The bill has a -1 amendment that is also in your packet. The -1 amendment adds an emergency clause to measure. We have received back a statement of no revenue impact, but have not received a statement of fiscal impact. But we have it just for public hearing today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. My role here is simply to introduce the chairs of the Oregon Growth Board. I am your ex officio non-voting member on the Growth Board. I think it's one of the best things we're doing in the state to promote economic development, to fill capital gaps, and to provide returns to the Education Stability Fund. We have a very small change that we want to make that we think is going to have a very big impact, and I'm going to let the chairs introduce themselves and describe the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Patricia Moss, and I live in Bend, Oregon, and I'm Vice Chairman of Bank of the Cascades.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jerry Langler. I live in Portland, and I'm co-chair of the committee, but I'm also a partner at OVP Venture Partners, a venture capital firm.
Thank you. Go ahead. Who would like to begin?
Thank you. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we want to go very briefly through a little bit of history on the Oregon Growth Board, just for those of you who are not as familiar to know what it is and what we do, and then really go into the issue about why we want this this bill and this amendment changed. So the Oregon Growth Board has two parts. The big part is called the Oregon Growth Account. It's been in place since 19...
Mr. Chairman, interrupt for just a second. We can see it on this screen, but I don't know if you can see it up here. I want the committee to make sure...
And if we could lower the lights a little bit, too, please.
There it is.
Okay.
Sorry,
no. So the Oregon Growth account has been in place since 1999, so predating all of us here. And then the Oregon Growth Fund was a small thing put in place in the 2013 general session. We're not going to be talking about the Oregon Growth Fund part of this today. It's the Oregon Growth Account. That's about $100 million of assets that comes from lottery money dedicated to do two things. One is to fill the capital gaps in the state for growing businesses, and the other is provide returns for the Education Stability Fund. So it's a two-headed goal. They don't have to be in tension right now. They're a little bit in tension, and that's the purpose of this legislation, is to fix that problem. And the way we do this on the Oregon Growth Account side is we take the money we get from the lottery. We then, in turn, invest that in funds, so partnerships that invest in companies. We do not invest in any companies directly ourselves. They, in turn, invest in Oregon startups and growth companies. When those companies are successful, the returns go back to the fund. Our portion of those returns come back to us, and then we either can reinvest those in more funds, or we can provide returns for the Education Stability Fund. The Education Stability Fund used to be at the discretion, the dividends used to be at the discretion of the treasurer. That changed a couple years ago, and now it is under our responsibility, and we don't have a policy about when we will do that, and we actually returned $4.3 million to the Education Stability Fund in December. So the side letter, which is what we are trying to resolve here in Bill 4020. The law has been on the books for quite a while, but in 2007, the Department of Justice changed its interpretation of the law. So before 2007, funds could be invested in by our predecessors without signing this side letter that contractually obligated them to invest a dollar in Oregon for every dollar we invest in them. And then since 2008, that has been in place, and so we've been operating under that basis. I think that the issue here is, on the surface, it seems quite reasonable, right? We're investing in them. They should invest in Oregon. That's the part of the purpose of our responsibility. The practical issue is that the really strong funds who don't need our money won't sign it. If they have a $100 or $200 million fund and the most we're going to put in is $5 million, they're not going to sign that. Even if they're already coming to Oregon, even if we know they're almost certainly going to invest in Oregon, they won't sign that side letter. And so what happens is we have a negative selection bias. We are kept out of the strongest funds by that, even though we think they would, and actually know in many cases, they would be here in any event. So we don't want to just be limited to the weaker funds. We want to be able to be in the strong funds, and this legislation would allow us to have the flexibility to get the letter, side letter, when we can. But if we can't, and it's a fund we really think will benefit Oregon by being in, we can go ahead and invest in that fund.
I might just add that the remedy, whether we have the side letter or not, the remedy is the same. If a fund has promised to invest in Oregon and they don't invest in Oregon, then we call them in front of the board and ask what they're doing and how they're going to make that investment in Oregon, and then we don't invest in them on the next round. The remedy, whether you have the side letter or not, is the same, because you're not going to sue a fund for not investing in Oregon because you won't have any funds then that will accept your money. So whether you have the side letter or not, our remedy for that action is the same.
I think one of the interesting comments was made by one of your fellow legislators in this building when we were going through this process of describing this, and she said at the end of the conversation, so what you're telling me is you don't want to try to operate this board with one hand tied behind your back. He said, yes, that's exactly it. And we have actually some interesting data as well. Because we had the situation where through 2007 no side letter was required, and since 2008 it has been, we actually have an A versus B case. And it turns out that, interestingly, before 2008, for every dollar the Oregon Growth Account invested in funds, more than $2 were invested in our state by those funds. And since then, still more than one, so it's doing well in either case, but it's only half the rate. Frankly, we don't know why that is. But we can speculate. And one of the things is the weaker funds, which we are getting into by definition to some degree with this 2008 on, are more likely to want to flip their investments quickly. They're not going to want to build major enterprises because they are trying to show progress to their investors so they can raise another fund, perhaps of a larger size. That could be it. There could be one other thing, which is simply once people have signed a contractual obligation and met it, then they can say, we're done. You know, we don't have to do anymore, as opposed to focusing on investing in companies that could get them the best return that happen to be in Oregon. One other quick thing, just again, it's not party to the legislation, but we thought you ought to know how the fund has done and its history, because I think it's relevant here. This fund, again, was started in 1999, the worst possible time to invest in venture capital partnerships in the history of the world. And in the years that immediately followed, also known as the bubble era, the investments in those partnerships yielded a negative 25% compound rate of return. I mean, a very deep hole. Since that period's passed, the results have gotten markedly better. For all time, that's the 2.5%, including carrying that boat anchor behind us, the fund is in the black. But since 2004, the returns are 6.75%, so rapidly approaching the new PERS targets. And since 2009, it's attractive indeed. And again, we're not trying to optimize the returns by themselves, because we still have to focus on making sure these funds invest in Oregon companies. But we do have an obligation to the Education Stability Fund to do a good job for them while doing the other. So the progress has been very nice. Just a couple quick facts, and then we will certainly be happy to take any questions you have. We had a very clear demonstration of the impact of this at the end of the last full session. We had a proposal in front of the legislature to remove this side letter restriction, and it didn't pass. And we had $40 million of potential investments in funds that we had already screened. This is not just all funds. These are the ones we thought would be really good for the Oregon Growth Account and Oregon companies. And the day that that side letter didn't pass, that 40 went to 15, because there were a number of funds that said, no, thank you. And, in fact, I'm wearing the impact of one of those on my wrist. Not from that period, but from a slightly earlier period, is a company called True Ventures out of Colorado that has invested in Oregon, and we wanted to get into early in the life of the new Oregon Growth Board. They would not sign the side letter, and so we didn't get in. One of the companies they invested in is a company called Fitbit. Fitbit is this little activity tracker on my wrist. It tells me I haven't done enough exercise today. And to give you a sense of the impact of that, the Fitbit investment by itself was about a 50 times return. It returned more than twice the total of the four funds True Ventures had ever raised. Now, we can't be guaranteed that that will ever happen again in anything we do, but it's the kind of thing that happens when you're in the top funds, and we want to make sure we're in those top funds.
Which is also also in the bill, there's an emergency clause, and the reason that's in place is we now have, if this bill passes, we want to be able to access a pool of funds that are available, and we have several potential investments that will close before June, and that's the reason to have the emergency clause in the bill.
Thanks, Becky. And then a couple other things on the issue about, are the companies that are being invested in mattering to Oregon? You can see that OGA funds have invested in almost 150 Oregon companies now. Thousands of jobs have been either created or supported. Well over $150 million in payroll taxes generated. And the Education Stability Fund is also reaping the benefits of this. So with that, any questions?
Representative Reed?
Madam Chair, I would just underscore what the co-chairs have indicated, that it's a short session, so hopefully it's a short bill. It's changing shall to may and adding the emergency clause so that we can take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of us. I hope you'll support it.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. I appreciate it. Having advised some investment funds through the years, I know what my response would be if I were presented with such a side letter. I would tell my client not to sign it. But what has the response been, and why is this? I think we've given us a good overview, but in the specific instance of funds that say thanks but no thanks to your side letter, what's the rationale
that's been given. I won't, without putting
my
rationale.
So, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Davis, thank you for your question. Their answer is pretty straightforward, is we don't need to close our fund because they have more demand in their fund for investors than they have space for investors. And independent, even if they would sign it, their other investors won't let them, because the other investors are financially driven only, mm-hmm. And all they care about is returns. And so for them to say, well, we're going to put $5 million into Oregon companies, those other investors are going to say, well, what if we don't find any good companies in Oregon? Why are you going to do that? So the investors won't let them, even if their intent is to do it.
As a follow-up, maybe money with strings attached isn't quite as good as an investment, just a straight piece of cash.
Yes.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you for your testimony today. We appreciate you being here.
We're moving
very swiftly, so you can...
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll look for a posting for a work session on Wednesday.
Thank you.
So I will close the hearing on House Bill 4020, and I will open a hearing on House Bill 4039. And I think Mr. Zwicker and Senator Johnson are here.
Madam Chair, permission to haul up a visual aid?
Certainly, Senator. Patrick, would you give us an update, please, or a rundown?
House Bill 4039 modifies the definition of rural airport for purposes of the through-the-fence operations pilot program. It also repeals the requirement that non-resident pilots register with the state of Oregon prior to piloting aircraft into the state. It has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. The bill currently has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water.
Much better. Thank you.
And there's no revenue impact on the measure, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Who would like to begin?
I will.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. In a previous life, I was the Aeronautics Administrator for the state of Oregon and have been involved in aviation for 30 years in the state. Excuse me, I just ran down here. The reason that we have brought this display, and I'm a little bit reticent to talk about it, given that the architect of the economic success of this airport is sitting in the back of the room, but I'm going to give it a shot, and if I lie, he can come up here and correct me. I wanted to give you a little bit of background about why through the fence matters in Oregon airports. For years, it has been the position of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, that they need to own, manage, control, and dictate uses of every square inch of an airport. That resulted in airports being choked off of economic opportunity. And back in 2005, the state of Oregon articulated a policy that said that they would be willing to recognize and, in fact, invite private capital to take private risk to spur economic activity at airports. Displayed before you is the Aurora Airport. It is the largest and most complicated airport in Oregon's portfolio, and it is actually the airport that gives rise to this very simple piece of legislation. But the thing that I want to point out to you is the south end, and I will speak loudly so that the microphone can pick me up. The south end of this airport is a perfect example of why through the fence matters. This airport, as I said, is owned by the state of Oregon. On the north end is Columbia Helicopters, one of the largest heavy lift helicopter companies in the world, with a reputation in emergency management, fire suppression, humanitarian activities, huge company, 800 employees, maybe more than that now, but a very significant company. On the south end is nearly $80 million?
It's over 100.
Over 100. I'm ways and means. What's a couple of those? $100 million of private investment. And what we're talking about with through the fence is the state of Oregon owns the major asset at this airport, which is the runway. But what we have done at Aurora is to invite private companies to take risk with private capital, come on fee simple property, literally through the fence, generally managed by contract, and use the largest asset of the airport, which is the runway. And what this has done is to encourage dynamic, responsible, important growth
And Mr. Millar, who has been the architect of this, will describe the kind of companies that are there. This has turned Aurora into an economic powerhouse in the county and is an example nationally of why it is that relaxing the rigors of the strictures, the FAA saying we have to own control, do everything. this airport has been held up as a national model for how to generate economic activity that does not rely on public money. So Mr. Millar will describe the kind of things that are happening there, but suffice it to say, airports are no longer just places where airplanes take off and land. My home airport, Scappoose International, is the home to a company that is pioneering carbon composites. And instead of riveting airplanes together, they're baking airplanes together. The Red Bull Racer, they have built a wind foil mounted on a tri-hull catamaran that can go offshore for months remotely. It can do drug interdiction, marine research, and all that is made based on an airfoil concept that is developed at the Scappoose Airport. There is a company that has made a gyrocopter that is being sold to the Department of Defense for border security, urban police missions. There is an airplane called the Sherpa that is a short takeoff and landing airport that can take off with some phenomenal load, dozens of 55, maybe not dozens, a lot of 55 loaded gallon drums in the airplane. It can take off and land in 500 feet. A company that makes all kinds of ergonomic and energy attenuating seats for almost all of our military fleet. I have seen testimonials from pilots serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, mostly helicopter pilots, because that's where my interest is, where pilots would have been killed in crashes, but the seats attenuated the energy and they walked away alive. They've developed a mattress using the physics of drawing heat, temperature, and pressure away from the human body, prevents the formation of decubitus ulcers. The point that I'm making, and Sisters Airport bears this out too, airports are now the home of some remarkable innovation related to the aerospace cluster that we as a state have embraced. So this is such a simple bill. Mitch Swecker, the head of the Department of Aeronautics, looked around and said, gee, when we passed through the fence, there were some certain comments about what could occur through the fence with airports that had towers or didn't have towers. And lo and behold, our flagship airport in the intervening 10 years has built a tower. And so Aurora is out of sync with the statutes, as all this bill tries to do is to realign the statutes with the actual on-the-ground development at Aurora. I know that there are some detractors of airports, and Representative McLean, I'm looking at you because we share communication with one of them. There's nothing sinister about this bill. This just continues Oregon's commitment to recognizing the value of aviation. Our state aviation department predates the creation of the FAA by years, so we have a long, honorable history of pioneering innovations in aviation and in responsible airport management, and this bill is just one more step in that continuum.
Thank you, Senator. Director Swecker, welcome.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Swecker, the director of the Department of Aviation. This is a very tough act to follow, but I'm going to kind of continue where we started in January at the interim session. And there were questions asked by committee members about what's the purpose of this change. And I would reiterate that my whole intent of this was just to align what's happening, that the fact that we built an air traffic control tower at the airport, and the statute says right there in black and white, that a rural airport under the through-the-fence definition should not have a permanent air traffic control tower. So striking that one line to me was a logical way to go forward. And that's why I submitted this. I didn't have anybody ask me to submit it or anything. It was just my catching that we had a clause in the statute that made us out of sorts with what was actually happening now that we have put an air traffic control tower on the ground. I did find out some information because there were some very good questions by Representative McLean and others, that this started 2005, Senate Bill 680. In Senate Bill 680, there was no requirement there or no clause in there that said you could not have an air traffic control tower, and the population threshold at that time was 75,000. Mm. In 2009, my predecessor put forward a bill, Senate Bill 170, which included the clause that we're trying to strike now, that having an air traffic control tower, and changed the population threshold from 75,000 up to 500,000, increased the number of prototype airports that could have through the fence from 3 to 6. So I think the intent of the bill in 2009 was to expand through the fence, and we put a restriction in there, the tower, that maybe impacted our poster child for how to do it right, and that's Aurora State Airport. And then the 500,000 threshold increased to omit the Portland metro area, because those airports that have commercial air service, they don't want through the fence. And the FAA has frowned on it for years, and so they did not want to run afoul of the FAA. So by putting the 500,000 threshold, it omitted those airports that are in the Portland metro area, but left it open for airports around the state that wanted to. And quite frankly, there have not been any in addition to Scappoose and Aurora. Baker City was allowed, but I don't think they've been able to attract the kind of businesses that would enable that. And love to see them be able to, and they're welcome to under the current statute.
Well, thank you.
So subject to any questions, that is my testimony.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming and for such a thorough presentation, and it really does help with the visual aid, and it does help with the history, and to try to figure out why we were going from 2005 to 2009, and we were reversing what we had done not too long ago, and what the reasoning was behind it. And so that really, I appreciate all that information, and I think it puts the whole picture together. The only question that I had was that we all know that any kind of usage of the airport or, you know, of the runway, and the type of use and the amount of use and the size of the airport, all of those things have factoring into safety issues. And so as I pointed out when we were discussing this morning, that I'm just concerned that we think about, again, what we're doing and what we're qualifying either Scappoose or Aurora to do more of, and what some of the implications might be. We know this area is on septic tank. We know that they don't have, urban water sources. And those issues make a difference on how we deal with that area, what the implications are for other businesses and other parts of the community in that area. And so I want safety first. You want safety first. We want good economic development opportunities. We both want that. But I think that we have to sometimes try to figure out if there are implications that we're just not thinking about right now. And through the fence, you talked about it. FAA doesn't want residential, and most of it's safety and or compatibility. Okay, so they really frown on that one. As far as the economic issues, I think we're all trying to figure out, again, are we on safe ground here if we go forward with this bill to make sure we get those economic opportunities, that we make sure that people can do business and do business well, but also that we're paying attention to what's around the airport and what some of the safety issues will be if we enlarge the opportunity for economic development right here. So
may I respond?
Senator Johnson.
You've raised three issues that I wrote down. One of them was available water. The second one was residential through the fence. And the third was what I have characterized as rogue airports. None of us that are in aviation want to allow rogue airports to develop unbridled uses. And there's one that I can think of in Washington County that has been the source of a great deal of controversy. And frankly, for those of us that are responsible airport users, responsible airport operators, that particular airport has been a problem, and it is seen as a problem by the aviation community. There were lots of decisions made at the county level that have impacted that. There now have been a series of legal actions that I think will curtail additional growth there. But none of us embrace the notion of unbridled, unsafe usage in an airport that probably is poorly located for the kind of operations that are there. That's the first one. The second one is that we passed a bill last session that will address some of the water issues. And it was not without controversy, because there's been a lot of suspicion about other activities in and around Aurora. There are sufficient safeguards in the bill that it has to be a partnership between the airport and the municipality. So the airport isn't going to have the opportunity to just go off on its own. Airports use a lot of water. Hangars need to be sprinkled or need to have fire control, big developments that have aircraft and machine works in them are overseen by a variety variety of state and federal agencies. So I understand the issue of water, and I think the chances of depleting an aquifer by an airport, remote to non-existent. And then last but not least, you mentioned residential. There are some unique circumstances where residential is a good thing. The Independence Airport that has formed a community there, policed by the community under the aegis of the FAA, they are allowed to continue. So while the FAA doesn't like a lot of activities at airport, they have had to acknowledge and have done so at Independence that the Independence Airport is designed and structured and operated in a way conducive to safe aviation residential mix. There are examples all over the country of aviation air parks where people have chosen to live together in a residential community, that instead of having a car in your garage, you got an airplane in your garage. It happens in rural places all over the country. So I think that there are in place sufficient safeguards at both the state, the level, the county, and the municipal lines of government to make sure that that there are not rogue operations. And I am well aware of the one that you're talking about. That tail shouldn't wag the aviation opportunity dog.
And Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, I would only add that because there's an air traffic control tower at Aurora, it is a safer airport, much safer than it was without it, and I sleep better at night because of that.
Thank Not you. Only safe, but also a better neighbor. The tower can help with noise control over some populated areas.
Great. Any further questions? Well, thank you so much for bringing this to us again. I believe we have a work session scheduled for Wednesday.
Madam Chair, an inquiry on my part. I don't know about the subsequent referral. I don't know what gave rise to the subsequent referral.
Yeah, rural communities,
Patrick?
Right?
Madam Chair,
are you aware?
Yeah, I can tell you I spoke to the Speaker's office. Subsequent referral to land use was related in part to the questions that were just addressed, and I believe the Speaker's office indicated that if it's the committee's satisfaction that those concerns are not relevant to having a subsequent approval of land use, that the committee can request and will be granted rescinding the
Is that
referral.
Helpful?
I would respectfully ask that be the path.
That request
Thank
is
you
noted.
So much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Director. We have two other people signed up to testify.
I'm going to leave this up here. Mr.
That's
Millar
fine.
Is architect of the success hearing. Might as well have a picture of the airport he helped grow.
Great. Mr. Bennett and Mr. Millar, please join us. Thank you for being here, gentlemen.
Thank you.
In any order you choose.
My name's Ted Millar. I own Westwood Development Corporation and the South End Corporate Air Park at the Aurora Airport. Betsy and Mitch, of course, gave you an excellent background on everything, and so I don't think I can add much other than give you a little history that may help. I was on an economic development task force after one of our depressions, and I was part of the Citizens Advisory Committee, and we worked with the Oregon Economic Development Department. And they recognized, of course, at that time that the way transportation is working, that all the rural airports could not attract a major employer unless they had access to an airport that could encourage corporations to locate there. Because we were close to the biggest metropolitan area in Oregon, right next to Portland, the head of the Oregon Economic Development Department suggested that we couldn't solve all the state's problems at one time, but he suggested because airports have different categories, like Portland and Hillsborough is one category, Aurora's a Class B, next one, and then you have much smaller ones, you know, throughout the valley and over in eastern Oregon. So he said what he recommended is you pick like three airports of different categories and then develop a model for how that airport could be a major attractor for economic development. So we did exactly that. They named the Aurora Airport as the named airport, and then they allowed a couple of others to join later. And because of the success of that program, Aurora now has over 1,200 living wage jobs. And, of course, that brings on a different category of traffic because you're mixing larger corporate airplanes with small little airplanes. So that brought on the need for a control tower, which we finally got opened here two or three months ago, and it's being very successful. It still has some more things to work out, but it's been a huge safety factor, and we're still working on the noise issues. Like, we've got some of our friends back here, and I live in the same area they live in. We're all worried about safety, and we're worried about noise. And so we're working very hard with a very complicated FAA program to improve the noise issues, and it's been substantially better. But I think the big thing that I could just add is that it is badly needed around the state from an economic development standpoint to develop airports in those communities and use them as an economic development hub. And this is just one airport that became the primary one, and we've proved the success of it. So that's all I guess I can add. It's just that history. If I have, happy to answer any other questions, though.
Well, shall we finish the – would you like
I just have one quick question.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So I see quite a lengthy set of development buildings here. How much more room is there to expand?
There isn't a lot at Aurora.
It's getting pretty close to
in the master planning process that we all worked on for the last 5 years or so, they agreed to contain the airport within the roadway boundaries that are there now. But and then, of course, as the economic development efforts continue, they'll probably tear down older, smaller hangars and put in better, higher quality ones.
Okay. Thank you, Manager.
Okay,
you.
Well, then I have
Representative McLean.
If you look at that picture that's up in front of you, I mean, the roadways you're talking about, you still have, there's, what, 100, 200 acres on the end over there that are now in nursery.
I don't think that was included in the master plan. I think it just went from Arndt Road to Kyle Road,
Okay. Which
is before all of those. Big picture-wise, you know, 50 years from now, it should probably go clear down to Elon Road, but politically, I don't know if that would be advisable now.
Well, Madam Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
The reason I ask that is because, again, you know, whether Aurora right now, you know, is pretty small, and I'm not worried about the water aquifer or anything like that, but it's a situation where, again, when you're talking about political will, and that's a pretty large footprint, and we all have to have futures. And so, you know, the master plan for today, you're talking about, is like, what, 20 or 30, 40 years? Mm. Is that right? The master plan you were just talking about up to the middle road?
It was just redone now. Of course, they need to redo a master plan every 5 to 10 years.
Right. So, I mean, we're talking 5 to 20 years probably for that middle road type of footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I was just asking, because through the fence allows more development, which is good. We want more good, solid businesses. But we're talking about the implications to the services and to the community around, and what does it mean to the community around. So, and I love your tower. Your tower is great.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think you are going to have some good results out of that, not just safety, but your noise abatement plan, too. But I'm just trying to understand what this does. I mean, if we say through the fence is okay, even when you have a tower, which means you're probably bigger, and you have more customers, and you have maybe larger customers. And so I guess in that master plan that you were talking about, does it address that? How many more businesses, how many more acres of development, how much more in the way of the footprint being used, how much resource does that take? I mean, those types of things.
I believe when you read the master plan is pretty well done, and it's online. That talks about, you know, it's on the web. But realistically, most of the airport's going to contain the businesses that use their flight departments there, like FLIR is there.
Okay.
They have 8,000 employees, but yet they only have two airplanes.
Okay.
Wilson Construction, which is kind of a model company, they're a Camby company, have like 500, 600, 700 employees. Mm-hmm. Then they have several airplanes and helicopters here. So they just have a small group of their operation right at the airport. And then, of course, we have to go off the airport for services. Like the one company, Helicopter Transport, that located there, they put in a $32 million facility. And his thing when he came for the hearings that I attended said, well, we spend $50,000 a year at the local motels. Mm-hmm. We spend $50,000 at the local auto parts store for our trucks.
Yeah.
We spend $50,000 at the restaurants, all those different things. And so that's what's going on at the airport. We strongly support all the businesses in Aurora and Camby and Wilsonville. And it would be nice to be able to have some additional zoning right around the airport to where maybe they could have a restaurant that's closer to the airport, those kind of things. But we like farmland because the farmers don't complain about noise. And it's safe to land in a field if you had a problem rather than in a town. So we prefer to be a rural airport right next to a busy area.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions?
Okay. I have one.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. To go back to the water issue, is there a jurisdiction nearby that would have a water system that maybe you could bring into the airport so that you would have something more reliable than
groundwater? Well, we've had a lot of conversations with the city of Aurora.
Yeah.
Wilsonville, of course, has a much bigger water supply because apparently they're selling water to all the surrounding cities. But I don't think the political will is there to have any more development south of the river. Than that seems to be their big issue, is anything south of the river. Mm-hmm. But like I'm drilling a new well right now just because it isn't adequate.
Yeah.
The old one isn't adequate. So it'd be nice to have public water, especially for fire safety.
Mm-hmm.
We've got huge tanks underground, but it would be better if we had a much larger water supply for fire.
And so since the development's there, it would be, to my mind, it's just me, I would think it would be logical to want to, you know, for Wilsonville to want to partner with you. It's not like you're going to pave over all of that farmland, but it would certainly be better for safety, I would think.
I agree. Yeah, yeah, we'd like that.
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Bennett, Aurora Aviation, and my family bought property on the Aurora Airport through the fence property in 1968, and I've been flying out of there since 1974. Own and operate Aurora Aviation. We're a flight school, air charter, a commercial air travel charter. It's nothing scheduled. Most of it's emergency, business emergencies, forest fires, life-saving ambulance flights. But we've been open 7 days a week since 1968. Maintenance department, a lot of young individuals found careers that way. You know, we hire them as fuelers or receptionists, and they'll come out as professional pilots. Anyway, I'm mostly here to answer any questions, if you had any, on airport operations. And then I just have 2 points. Back to the chart in front of you, you can see it's almost completely developed. So with Highway 551 running parallel to it, it is forever a one-sided airport. Most airports have ramp space on both sides of the runway. You can't build off the end because for takeoff and landing, there's a height restriction. So you build off the sides. And because of Highway 551, Aurora is a one-sided airport. And as you can see, it's surrounded by you can't taxi an airplane across a public street. So the airport road runs parallel to it, Island Road on one end and Kyle Road. It's pretty much filled up as far as the usable real estate. The growth is there's a little bit of room, but not much. And then one thing, I'm a FAA, I take a flight test with the FAA every 6 months, and we're a FAA-approved flight school, and I'm very highly regulated by the FAA, and I was involved in the tower construction. And I can tell you the Federal Aviation Administration only has one reason for building a tower, and that's safety. There are other benefits. There's noise and some commercial, but they don't register or take any into account. It's strictly a safety factor in building a control tower.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Bennett?
Where's the tower?
It's not on, though. I can show you where it is.
This is May of 13, and this is 3 years old, yeah.
No, it's like the old joke. If it were, it would be up.
Best blacktop right in the middle of it.
Right there. Yeah. Thank you.
Certainly.
Gentlemen, thank you for being here today. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to make comments on House Bill 4039 today? Then we will close the hearing on House Bill 4039 and open a hearing on House Bill 4047. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4047 increases speed limits for certain highways, including State Highway 197 from Klamath Falls to the California state line, and Interstate 82 from the intersection with Interstate 84 and the Washington state line. The measure has an emergency clause would become effective upon passage. We received a revenue impact statement of no revenue impact, but not received the fiscal yet.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Davis, and Vice Chair Gorsuch. Greg Barreto, State Representative, House District 58. This is basically a cleanup bill. We introduced this bill last year. It increases the speed on I-84 from the Dalles down to Ontario and then several highways in between from 97 and 197 east. The cleanup is a couple of arterials. Well, one, Interstate 82 that goes from Hermiston up to the Washington border, and that's about a 10-mile stretch. So the increase in the speed it goes from 65 to 70 for vehicles and from 55 to 65 for trucks. And so we would include that stretch from Hermiston up to Washington. And what that does, it also gets the speed more in line with Washington. So coming to and from, for cars, there's no difference. I think for trucks, it's 55 or 60 to 65. Same thing down in on Highway 97, down south of Klamath Falls. There's a 15-mile stretch there that we didn't include. And so this just completes Highway 97 from Klamath Falls down to the California border, cars at 65, trucks at 60, which also lines up pretty closely with California. They have 70 for cars and 60 for trucks. And so simple cleanup bill. Much simpler than the Aurora Airport.
And we're grateful,
but
Representative.
If I may make a comment, the tower will make it much safer to fly into Aurora.
We appreciate that. Any questions for Representative Barreto? Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I just want to thank the Chair again for allowing us to bring this bill last session. Thank you so much. And one of the benefits of the bill that wasn't immediately apparent is the is a meeting that we had in regard to the closing of the container, the difficulty in getting containers out of port. Mm-hmm. And it appears that the only positive thing we've done for freight is to increase the speed limit to allow us to drive these things more quickly down the road. Mm-hmm. And I'm not joking.
I believe
it's
you.
A great big deal, and it was brought up by 8 or 10 different people saying, hey, this will actually help us move freight more quickly. So so thank you again for that opportunity in this bill.
And Representative Bentz, we all know that when freight moves, commerce is good, and it benefits all of us from border to border. So I appreciate you acknowledging that. It's something I hadn't thought of. Thank you. Mr. Mather, did you want to comment? And Representative Barreto, thank you for being here today. We appreciate it very much. We'll get this tidied up. And
again, thank you for hearing this bill and for working it through last year.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator, Representative Barreto did a good job covering the bill. Again, just refer to the map that's attached to the testimony that I provided. I think does a good job kind of explaining visually what Representative Barreto was explaining. The other point I would point out is the original bill goes into effect March 1st, so all the other speeds are going to be going up March 1st. We've done the preliminary work and are ready to implement on March 1st these same two sections, but obviously the bill needs to be passed and signed by the governor in time for March 1st so we don't end up with that gap, kind of a speed trap for motorists going to and from Washington or to and from California.
Well, we plan on working the bill on Wednesday. We'll get it over to the other side, and hopefully you don't bog down over there and try and get this done so you can implement it all at one time. It makes perfect sense. Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
closing the hearing on House Bill 4047 and opening a hearing on House Bill 4048. Mr. Brennan again.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Or Madam Chair, sorry. Mr. Chair was the last meeting an hour ago.
We're all moving very quickly.
House Bill 4048 reallocates monies for transportation projects that were allocated by House Bill 2001 and 2009. It also has an emergency clause and will take effect upon passage. There is no amendment. And not expect to have a fiscal revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. I believe Mr. Mather is on deck one more time. And Ms., I'm not going to pronounce this correctly.
They did not.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Madam Chair, member of the committees, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Back to you again, another session, another JTA bill. This time we are moving funds from a completed Woodburn Interchange project that got done a year ahead of schedule and $7 million under budget. So we're able to take the savings from that project and meet two other needs of two other JTA projects, sticking with our discipline of keeping those in the same region. Moving $3.5 million of that, exactly $3.5 million, to the Kubler Interchange project, where we added scope and added an additional lane on I-5. And then any remainder of the projected $7 million savings on Woodburn to the Tillamook project. So I'm a little specific there in my language in that what the bill does is allow our commission the authority to move the remaining savings to Tillamook. That way we can get every penny out without having me come back to you again with yet another bill to move the last penny out. So we're going to move $3.5 million specifically to the Kubler project, and then any remaining, the projected amount is 3.5, but any remaining amount give the Transportation Commission the authority to make that move from Woodburn to the Tillamook project.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Benz.
I just want to point out, Madam Chair, that there's a moral to this, and that is we always want to pass these transportation packages during the depths of recessions, really bad ones, and we get these incredible savings, which we can then spread out much further. Mm-hmm. Because I think at the time, no one anticipated the type of savings you guys have been able to achieve here. And it was all bad news, of course, because of the recession. But on the other hand,
silver lining.
Madam Chair, Representative Bent, yeah, we've received very competitive and very favorable bids on the majority of our JTA projects, allowing us to take those savings and reapply those.
Representative Davis, and then Representative Gorsuch.
First, a question, Paul, and if you said this and I missed it, I apologize. Thanks for being here, by the way. Yeah. Remind me, why is the Kubler project over budget, or are you doing more with it?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, we're actually added scope to that project. So the original project was just to add the additional ramp on the interchange itself, and we're extending that ramp almost a mile up the freeway to continue the three lanes south on I-5.
Thank you.
It provides kind of a climbing lane for the trucks in that area. Right now, as that lane drop, your trucks are coming up a hill as well as an on-ramp coming in there. We're smoothing that out and adding that additional lane and ultimately, hopefully, having funds to complete that three lanes all the way through Salem, which we've like to do sometime.
Yes.
Thank you, Paul. And for the benefit of the committee, I wanted to give a heads up that I think we briefly heard during the interim about some discussions with local governments taking place regarding another project in the same region, which is the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. Mm-hmm. And those groups are engaged or beginning to engage in a mediation process right now to try to avoid litigation about a certain portion of that bypass so we can keep it on time, keep it on budget. That could potentially require an alteration and shifting of some of the funding for Newburgh-Dundee bypass that this bill might be a vehicle for. There's also a Senate bill that could potentially be on the table for that. But I just want the committee to know this may be a little more interesting than some previous JTA reallocations, or the parties may not come to agreement and we won't have any opportunity to reach a solution and we won't do anything else with this bill except for what you see.
We will wait patiently, Representative Davis. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mather, if I could go back to a question that I asked when we were talking about all of the various projects back in the last legislative days. Were you able to find out the status of the striping and the reflective little squares on Highway 26 in that area from Government Camp down towards Zigzag?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, I did follow up with a note to our regional folks, but I did not get a response back exactly what they've done with that. I'll follow up with better and get you a more complete
answer. Yeah, if you could just contact my office, that'd be great.
Do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mather.
Any other questions? Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Paul, you seem to just be squeezing money everywhere. So when's the next one that we can expect this magic money to just pop out? This is great. These are the best bill in every session.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Davis, I was looking through all the JTA projects. We really have about six of them that are kind of left in play, where we haven't taken some action on to kind of resolve or get a path forward on where we're going to spend the savings. There's really about six of them yet in play. Three of those are kind of partway through construction, and three of those are set to go to bid later on this year. And so once we get through the bidding of those, I think we'll have a pretty good handle on the wrap-up on the JTA program.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here, Mr. Mather.
Thank you.
And on that note, we will close the hearing on House Bill 4048. Mr. Brennan, can you give us an update on what we'll be doing on Wednesday, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have work sessions scheduled on all four of these bills on Wednesday. And then we also have hearings scheduled for House Bill 4078 and House Bill 4089.
Great.
And I can give you a brief. 4078 deals with the would create a transit expansion fund, and 4089 deals with corrugated cardboard pallets.
Mm. Exciting.
So everyone, stay tuned.
Spoiler alert.
Mm. Anything for the good of the order? All right, on that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all.